Welcome back to our SmackDown Companion for 1989. This is your host, Nathaniel R. I am here with Tasha Robinson from The Dissolve, Todd Vanderwerf from Vox, Kevin B. Lee from Keyframe, Tim Roby from The Telegraph, and Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks. We return now to our conversation. We're talking about the supporting actress nominees of 1989 and their films. Now we hit the big hits of the category. Parenthood and Steel Magnolias, they were both really big hits at the time. And in some ways, they're kind of still relevant now in that all of these performers are, you know, recognizable. A lot of them are still working. And so it was interesting to see, you know, that long ago, like Joaquin Phoenix, for example, in Parenthood. And just remember, wow, he's come a long way since then. So did any of you see these when they were in their first release? What was your specific memory of those? I know, Kevin, you had mentioned the vibrator joke as a singular moment, and I thought...
Oh, yeah. I remember the audience, you know, that when that happened, and just like... And this little girl is like, is that a massager, mommy? You know, so... that's such a, like, a proto-Apatow-type humor,
uh-huh.
Which, you know, and from 2014, that kind of, like, bro kind of oriented humor,
right?
Just feels kind of dated or pretend, you know, just sort of on its way out. And just to see it when it was kind of breaking through, it's a weird kind of disorienting sense of what it was like, you know, what was this, 25 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was strange that you mentioned that though, because I had totally forgotten about that scene and you called it the signature moment. But the scene that I had remembered from 25 years ago when I was young, I saw this with my parents actually. And they were horrified at all the sex talk and like the blowjob scene and and all that. And so that's what I remembered was the blowjob in the car, which is not shown or anything; it's just discussed. But
the thing I remember is actually the photograph mix-up, which I've always confused with the one in Shortcuts, where there's a very similar scenario where someone gets the wrong photos and kind of comedy ensues. But specifically Diane Wiest's, I think this is my favorite line. That's the one that sticks out for me. It was probably the first time I ever saw or noticed or became aware of Diane Wiest in a movie, I think. But this is where I also have to have my gay card retracted, because until a year ago, I had never seen Steel Magnolias. I had never, somehow never come across it.
I think I saw maybe 15 minutes of Parenthood on video, but I was just young enough that my parents sent me to bed because it was too mature for me. Mm-hmm. So I hadn't seen it until a couple of years ago when I watched it because I was reviewing the TV show. And Steel Magnolias, I saw, you know, as a young kid when it came out or came to TV or something, and I thought it was fine. I don't remember liking it all that much, but I was also like 11, so that wasn't going to happen.
I watched Steel Magnolias for the first time 2 or 3 years ago, after being basically told to by my female friends, kind of told it was a female rite of passage along the line of reading Flowers in the Attic and what's the other thing? Outlander, the novel. Apparently these are things that you have to punch on your bingo card or you're not actually a woman. But Parenthood I saw back in the day, and I loved it. Even though I was a teenager when I saw it, as I kind of said in the write-up, I was much, much closer to the age of the... what's her name?
Martha Plimpton?
Yes, thank you. I was much closer to Martha Plimpton's character's age, and I still find myself sympathizing a lot more with the adults in this movie, which was just a very strange thing for me. But when I look back on it, what I remember more than anything else is the horrible business at the end with Steve Martin on the make-believe roller coaster, which, wow, like even as a metaphor, that's a little bit weak, but the literalizing of it. So ridiculous.
I remember this is so embarrassing, but I remember being totally moved by that and crying when I was a kid and saw this. And now I felt the same way. Now I was like, oh, this is not how I remembered this. This is very awkward.
Literalized enough, everybody needs a baby.
Yes.
Babies care about
everyone has babies. Steve Martin is pregnant. Tom Hulse is pregnant. Chris Robarts is pregnant.
Babies
everybody.
Yeah, one thing, the reason that I brought up the sex thing is one thing I'm curious about the rest of you is I was I know in a lot of ways it's dated, and in a lot of ways it's not good, even though it's a very enjoyable film. But, like, I was horrified, speaking of dated, I was horrified by that whole, like, hallucination of, like, the gunning people down.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Which I don't remember being as distasteful back then, but maybe I just wasn't, you know, aware enough.
Well, it was pre-Columbine, pre, you know, every annual shootout in the school. Yeah.
Yeah, but the sex conversations and the sex thing, even just in the conversations that aren't directly about sex, like there's a scene early in the movie where Steve Martin and Mary Steenburgen can't quite have sex because they're worried about their kids. Even that seemed a lot more adult than what we get in movies now.
Hmm.
Like, that you're inside people's bedrooms and that you get a sense of what their sex lives are like. Like, I don't... It seems to me movies have regressed in a lot of ways, even though this does feel like an older film, so it was a weird feeling I was having when I was watching it.
You know, the shooting thing was pre-Columbine, but it was, you know, it was well after the Charles Whitman bell tower shootings, which is what it was almost certainly based on, visually speaking. But that moment really worked for me, because I think it plays in a maybe a little over-the-top comedic way, but I think it plays pretty accurately into a parent's sense that you never know what's going to traumatize your kids. You never know what it is that you do wrong that they're going to remember for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of that sense that, like, every single moment of a child's childhood can potentially be emotionally fraught. Mm-hmm. And that sense that you can't protect them from everything. Like, I really feel for Steve Martin in that moment of just, I'm trying to do something good here, and it completely came apart, and who knows, maybe it'll have repercussions forever. And, like so much of parenthood, it is very sitcom-y. It is very over the top. It does play in kind of a ridiculous, forced way, especially when the camera just pushes in on his face and it's like, now I'm going to make a comedy face just before we cut to this, you know, to the bell tower shootings. But that said, I think there's so much like actual emotion underlying this film that even when it gets shticky, I could swallow everything except the roller coaster business at the end, which is just a bridge too far.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
My feeling was of being sort of enormously let down by the way that this movie promises not a Robert Altman film, but a much more textured, much more minor key, much more like lower conflict version of just looking at lives of these people trying to raise their children, and you know that sort of comes up in that first little segment we have with Steve Martin and Mary Steenburgen, where they're just, you know, they're going about their day. They went to the baseball game with the kids and so on and so on. And you get some of Steve Martin, you know, making exaggerated comic faces because that's what he's really known for. But it's very sort of lovely and textured in a way that the rest of the movie isn't, because then we immediately start moving into much broader, much hackier stuff. And the movie never really returns to that realistic normal core. It becomes very much, you know, we're going to have wacky moments and goofy shenanigans and sorts of, you know, farcical misunderstandings. Mm-hmm. And it just I can overlook a lot of stuff about its datedness if I feel like I'm hooked into the story and sort of feeling like these are real people. But I just, once you got past that opening section, I never could feel like these were people who actually existed in reality rather than, you know, constructions of the script.
Sure.
I felt they were real in moments. I mean, I really felt that the Joaquin Phoenix stuff, I mean, talk about something that doesn't really get discussed in movies today, except for like the broadest and most explicit of comedies, is just the idea that he doesn't have a father figure to talk to about the fact that he's looking at porn and masturbating.
Right.
And the fact that that poor Diane Wiest has to bring in Keanu Reeves to talk to him.
Right.
That whole interaction.
Anything you would rather talk to Keanu Reeves about than Diane Wiest? Hard.
I don't know. I really like the whole interplay there between, you know, the teenage kid who's kind of off on his own and can't talk to anybody, and eventually talks to this just like goofy, semi-lovable, semi-asshole that Diane Wiest doesn't even like. And like the little speech that that Reeves gives about, you know, I just told him that's what little dudes do, and then he was happy. And Wiest just looks so naked for a second, and she says, "Gary was happy." I mean, I think that's a really authentic moment, and it's really sweet. And I also think that the film knows that it's camp, because Reeves has that little conversation about how, you know, any butt-reaming asshole can become a father. You know, you need a license to drive, you need a license to fish, you don't need a license to, you know, to produce a kid and abuse them. And there's a moment there where there's naked emotion, and Diane Weiss kind of moves toward him, and then he just jumps back into camp. I think the film knows exactly what it's doing there, which is giving you one authentic moment and then kind of, you know, yanking the tablecloth out from under the dishes and going, you know, psych.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the actors do make it funny, which I think counts for a lot. I was struggling in my head with having had an experience recently with This Is Where I Leave You, the new Jason Bateman, Tina Fey, Jane Fonda ensemble dramedy where the family are called the Altmans and we're doing some serial comic drama. And that movie just fails to be funny at all and doesn't feel real, so you're kind of left with nothing. Mm-hmm. And I thought here at least, you know, Ron Howard was bringing a bit of his kind of sitcom timing into it, and the actors were really helping him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, both of these movies being ensembles, I would love to hear what everyone's favorite performances was from each. From Parenthood, I love Diane Weiss. I would have voted for her in this category. I think she does bring the authenticity that some people feel is missing from the movie, and she has such range in her comedy. And then from Steel Magnolias, my favorite is easily Sally Field, but I have a very complicated relationship to Steel Magnolias. I was feeling very envious when Tim said he had never seen it. Because I have seen it so many times, I can't get away from it, and sometimes I would really like to.
I really like Dolly Parton in it, actually. Oh, yeah. And I think she's so often just sort of, unusually for Dolly Parton, she's just kind of in the background of scenes, and yet I'm kind of into whatever she's doing in the salon or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think maybe she's my favorite in that one. And I like what a couple of us said about Lee Phoenix in Parenthood being like incredibly promising. Mm-hmm. And it's funny trying to kind of see Joaquin's face in that kid, and kind of trying to sort of join the dots, if you like, to the later performances from I guess To Die For onwards.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I thought he was doing a lot of great stuff, and actually having singled out those scenes with Diane, I think those are the best in the film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Dolly Parton is my favorite thing in everything.
Good answer.
I mean, it's really, really hard to beat her. I think I gravitate towards Shirley MacLaine a little more in Steel Magnolias, just because she has all the best lines, and there's kind of a layer, like a thick, warm blanket of schmaltz hanging over the entire film that she just cuts through like incisively with a knife. And I love it. I love that the film lets her do that. That the film acknowledges like openly that some of this is, you know, cheesy and a little bit ridiculous. And it acknowledges that she's in many ways kind of a horrible person, mm-hmm. but it still like lets her have fun with that role. With Parenthood, Weist is my favorite. Weist will always be my favorite. But I also want to give a shout out to Jason Robards, who is not giving into the camp of the film at all, I think, mm-hmm. who plays it pretty straight. And I think he's the only reason the whole arc with him and Tom Hulce works at all. Because that, like, it's less shticky, but the whole, you know, gangsters are coming for me, Dad, arc just doesn't seem to fit into this film at all. And I really like the interplay between them, just as, like, the idea that problems with your kids don't stop when they're, you know, when they're out of high school. Mm-hmm. And I really think that the way Robards plays it, if nothing else, especially in that final scene where he kind of tries to offer Hulce a compromise, really, like, elevates what's otherwise a pretty ludicrous plot twist.
Mm-hmm. I really liked the interplay between Shirley MacLaine and Olympia Dukakis in Steel Magnolias. I actually feel like most of the performances in Steel Magnolias are really nice, sort of measured performances in a movie where it tips over into melodrama quite a bit, and that's often a hard balance to achieve, and that's one of the things I really appreciate about it. And in Parenthood, you know, I liked Diane Weiss. I didn't give her as many hearts as everybody else because I think I was holding it against the film in some ways. But I also thought Keanu Reeves. This reminded me of when he wasn't yet sort of stoic action film Keanu Reeves, and he was sort of a winningly goofy performance, and I liked that about his work in this movie.
I love that moment when he was like, we can record our love. I absolutely love that moment. He was very endearing early on. How about you, Nick?
Also, like, he's just the biggest case I can think of an actor who, when he's placed in a role that is within his range, within his fairly limited range of things he can do, he's perfect. And yeah. He's perfect here. He's perfect in Bill and Ted. He's perfect in The Matrix, you know, which only requires him to be wooden. He's perfect and dangerous liaisons, which again lets him be wooden.
Yeah.
Pretty much, if you find like a Keanu Reeves fitting role, he's great. But people keep thinking he can act, and that's just a mistake.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'd say this is a good performance because it, you know, I would call it good acting in that it just brings a vibe that's kind of difficult to replicate. I mean, it's something that I would say is something that he has, and he hasn't really used in maybe 20 years. I mean, when was the last kind of loose performance that we saw from him? Maybe this film?
That's a good question.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, I agree. Like, Bill and Ted and this, I mean, he definitely had this comedic talent that he's just sort of let go to waste. It's unfortunate. Another thing I'm wondering with regard to Steel Magnolias, because, you know, there was all this writing generated around Herbert Ross's treatment of Julia Roberts and kind of the ensemble as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
The entire ensemble basically kind of circled the wagons and protected themselves, which is fascinating to think about, given that this ended up being Herbert Ross's, you know, biggest box office hit. The last big hit he ever had. And, you know, I mean, what was the dynamic that allowed for what you could call a successful film, you know, to mm-hmm. out of this? Was it successful in spite of that tension or somehow because of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if anybody was unfamiliar with that, I did look up the original article that started all this. Well, not that started all this, but that asked Herbert Ross directly about all this, because it started with, you know, the women sort of coming forward here and there saying that he wasn't nice. But he had called, he tells the interviewer, and this was from Movie Line, he tells the interviewer that he had called Julia to congratulate her or something after Steel Magnolias, and she was not nice, so I called to ask her why, or I asked her why, and she said, you weren't nice to me, and gave me a very hard time. I said, Julia, I was trying to get a performance out of you. She had a great deal of trouble because she could only play the top of scenes, bright and cheerful, in a general way, never understanding the subtext. We shot and shot, and I was somehow able to get that subtext out of her falsely by saying, that's not right, and getting her very nervous. I had desperately wanted Meg Ryan, and I was crazy about Winona Ryder, who was too young.
Right. You know, I kind of agree with him, because when she's playing the sickly diabetic, she's like the most energetic diabetic I've ever seen, you know? I mean, it's just, and that's why I love her. I love her so much in the opening scenes, because she's just radiant. I mean, she's just glowing, and it's really, boy, you really feel like the curtain is lifted and you're just seeing like this star emerge. And the thing is, like, that's because she has that raw sort of like vibrancy. It's just hard to buy her when she's dying.
I think we should maybe remember as well, this is around the era when Julia Roberts was herself kind of a bit notorious on set for being tricky on Hook,
right.
I think the crew on Hook just kind of couldn't stand her. Tinker Hell, I think, was the nickname. So you sort of wonder if there was a bit of a two-way street there.
Right.
She must have known that this was her big moment and that she wanted to milk it for all it was worth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, as evidenced by the photo that Nathaniel chose on the block entry, it's just like, drink the orange juice.
It just, that scene is so famous. Drink your juice, Shelby. That's why I use that.
Although, you know, so many of those of the other actresses in the movie who had been around long enough to say, we do understand the psychological games of direction, but that's one thing, and he was just awful to her.
No, I mean, he's gotten bad press from other actresses from other films. But I did think it was interesting that at least from his take on it, I, even though that you probably shouldn't say those things publicly, that I completely agreed with what he was saying. in terms of what she could do and what she couldn't do at the time, at least.
Right.
I mean, obviously, she definitely came into her star power because she's brilliant in Erin Brockovich and really good in some other things.
Yeah. I'm actually curious about Ron Howard as a director because, I don't know, I mean, it's my sense is that...
He likes when people only play the top of scenes.
Apparently, yeah. I feel like almost to a fault. I don't know, but I mean, listening to you guys kind of give the benefit of a doubt for how the tones sort of work, the campiness kind of works. Like, I'm definitely having second thoughts, but still, like, there's just nothing very subtle about it, at least as far as, you know, how I'm used to thinking about subtlety. And, yeah, I think he just sort of had a really good time with his ensemble. You can tell that it was a really fun shoot to be on from the outward appearance of it. But I just wonder, you know, it's just, and maybe that's the thing. It's just a fun movie. And maybe that's why it was so successful.
Parenthood.
Yeah, Parenthood. Yeah.
Kevin, they shot this movie in Orlando. Nobody has ever had a good time in Orlando.
I get the sense, I mean, this is not fair, but like in my experience of Parenthood and like a lot of Ron Howard movies, I feel like he is a director who does seem to prize a kind of emotional authenticity when it's happening in front of him. And there are scenes that many people have already mentioned in Parenthood that maybe some of those we haven't talked about as much are like watching Steve Martin continue to try to cope with the child with the anxiety disorders and just those close-ups of him looking so... of Steve Martin looking so helpless without trying to show the kid that. Like, but he doesn't seem like a director who I trust to kind of engender those moments or kind of lead from a place of emotional authenticity. So if the actors are going to bring it, it's not going to get cut out of the film. But that movie does seem like so jolly about its super punchline-y Babalu Mandel script that feels
Oscar
like...
Oscar nominated, right?
I don't think so.
Yes, it was, I think.
No...
I'm looking at it now. Looking it up right away.
Or maybe not.
But I don't know. The look of the movie looks a lot more like the script than it looks like the sincerity that some of the actors are bringing to it. Like there are just a lot of triggers that make it seem like a gift that they were able to deepen it as much as they could. But I just don't trust from this movie or from others that Ron Howard is the engine behind that. I love when Cate Blanchett, who's not super good at sounding nice, when she's trying to conceal a feeling when she was doing press for The Missing and when asked, like, what was it like to work with Ron Howard, said, he's just amazing. You know, I mean, if a machine could direct, it would be Ron Howard.
I talked about this a little bit on Twitter, but I feel like Ron Howard has always wanted to be like a Robert Altman type, when he'd be a little more like he does all these big ensemble movies that are supposed to have like multiple layers of tone and so on and so forth, but he usually ends up skewing towards sort of the most sentimental, schmaltzy, over the top comedic tones, just because I guess that's, you know, where he's most comfortable or what he knows how to do. And like when really he maybe probably would be better off like skewing more toward a Frank Capra thing where like he does have this fundamental optimism and sentiment and belief in humanity or whatever, but he also is willing to go for the darker stuff. And I think the few times that I've really liked a Ron Howard film, it has been a little more in that vein. Like Apollo 13 is very much like a celebration of Americana and all of this stuff and a celebration of, you know, astronauts and good old-fashioned ingenuity, and that is definitely more in that vein of like almost like a 40s programmer, you know, where it's right down the middle.
And it's very easy in something like Apollo 13 to know what to cut between. You know, you're cutting between space and not space. It's fairly straightforward. Whereas when he's got like this ensemble rangy cast of lots of stories, just deciding where to make the transitions and the jumps is really, so he seems quite vague about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always think back to this is a compliment for Nick. A long time ago, we did a little discussion about A Beautiful Mind, and Nick called it a crisis of direction. And I totally think that's the problem with his work. It's like he has good, great scenes in some of his movies, but it never seems like it's entirely what he intended, or that he sort of goes for what's happening. It doesn't seem controlled. Which is why it's hilarious that Cate Blanchett called him a machine. because it really doesn't seem to be that purposeful. It's like, I want to do all these different things, and then, you know, he just picks them, and they don't necessarily, like, string together perfectly.
Well, that's an interesting observation, because, I mean, for me, one of the problems with the direction is that it just feels overly programmatic. It feels overly smooth. You know, Altman had this kind of rangy 70s roughness, especially in, you know, films like Nash. This is sort of a sense of like trying to take in everything at once and just kind of rambling
right.
wherever you want
right.
it. Whereas Parenthood to me feels like a mechanically cut jigsaw puzzle. Like every single piece fits a little too flush, a little too precisely. It feels very neat and programmed in that polished Sakami kind of way.
Right.
I think that's what it comes down to, is just a sense of too much polish in the actors, in the scripting. And particularly in this just sort of, you know, very bright candy-colored version of Suburbia.
Mm-hmm. One question I wanted to ask, and Todd, since you write a lot about TV, I thought maybe you would have some perspective here. But when I was watching Parenthood with the boyfriend, and we were like, you know, there's not a lot of TV series or films anymore that are about sort of basic family drama. Mm-hmm. It seems like everything's very, like, trumped up, and it has to be way bigger than, you know, like just how to live everyday life.
Yeah.
And I was thinking when I was younger, there was a lot of TV shows that were just like about a family, let's say. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to be a genre that's active in either film or television. Like I can think of a couple TV shows that are like that, but they're all in like ABC Family, you know?
Yeah.
What do you think happened there? And does anybody want to support anything that is happening that I'm not aware of?
Well, oddly enough and ironically, well, not ironically, I guess, but one of these shows that is really doing this really well is the show Parenthood, which has had its problems over the years, but in its best episodes and its best seasons is really sort of the best possible version of this story, one that manages the tonal shifts well and tells interesting, illuminating, textured stories about what it is to raise kids nowadays. It's still very much, you know, about people who have enough money that they never have to worry about, like, real things.
Right.
But it's sort of the best version of that story.
Mm.
But what really has happened is it's so hard to get anything greenlit nowadays in both film and TV. Where you don't have that really high concept, high conflict, kind of like, we're really going to have some big things happening here. We're going to have a big twist. And it's really hard to get, even in TV, where they used to tell these kinds of stories all the time, to get greenlit, like, we're just going to do a show about this family, and, you know, he has his parents live across the street, and we promise it's going to be funny. Or, you know, we're going to do a show about what it is to be a married couple in your 30s. And one of the things I kept thinking of when watching Parenthood, because I think it's so obviously influenced by it, is the TV show 30-something, which was airing right around the same time as this, and also had, you know, they would do dream sequences or fantasy sequences that, you know, it worked much better in that show, but are obviously sort of the inspiration for a lot of what's going on here. And this Parenthood, in many ways, felt like an attempt to make a movie version of 30-something. And it just made me realize that, like, the late 80s were the only time when everyone was competing to do stories about really small, really, like, normal lives. And, you know, kitchen sink dramas or kitchen sink comedies, almost. And you also see that in things like Roseanne or
mm-hmm.
or some of these other, you know, TV shows that really dug into that world. And that's sort of gone away. And I, as much as I wasn't a huge fan of this film, I do like that it exists, and I miss when this was kind of a genre that seemed mm-hmm. like it was coming into its own.
Yeah, and I feel like some sort of weird turn happened with Sopranos where, you know, the only way you can really talk about family issues is to dress it up in some kind of Baroque fiction or, you know, fantasy, mm-hmm. pseudo-fantasy, pseudo-real world. Breaking Bad would be another example, I guess. But you know, there's one show that I feel makes an interesting contrast with this movie, and that would be Louie. I don't know, for some reason when you know, Nathaniel asked that question about what TV shows speak to this one, that came to mind, just almost as like this sort of stripped down, decimated, single parent version of Parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this weird kind of resonance between Louis C.K.'s character and Steve Martin's, and that they're kind of given to these nightmare fantasies that sort of spontaneously pop into their minds. Although I think, you know, Louis C.K. takes it much further, and you know, it's able to focus more on that realm of anxiety, and kind of multitask with all these other characters. I'd say I'd hold that as a pretty you know, top level example of this type of subject matter being given its due today.
Yeah, I mean, the reason it occurred to me, I think, is because so many of these films had the, and maybe this is true of supporting actress, and I just hadn't noticed it so prevalently because Diane Weiss wasn't being such a great mom, but that so many of these are about motherhood. So many of these films, you know, at least from the perspective of what we were looking at, you know. Mm-hmm. Where about actual mothering as opposed to playing a mother is what I mean.
Yeah, and the film, I guess, you know, to its credit, I think it does a pretty good balance between male and female parenting, like the different sets of concerns that, you know, Steve Martin has, where, or the way that it, you know, it reflects on his kind of his male ego versus Diane Wiest's, you know, a different feeling of helplessness. I wish I could characterize it right now, but I'm having trouble.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny that the movie about the guy with three wives who each have their own sort of circles of friends and communities is the one that feels least like an ensemble movie in this whole like visually and narratively, that movie has, I mean, I liked a lot of things about that movie, but it really does have trouble seeing past those four people, and sometimes even as far as that. And since we haven't said too much about Steel Magnolias as a movie, but I think it's amazing that that movie manages to kind of do something that I think Parenthood does, and I think does a little better, about giving a lot of actors chances to be hammy or play right to the bathhouse or do whatever, but they are creating really authentic relationships with each other, enough so that when we have that final payoff scene in the cemetery, you totally believe that that at every step of that really long, tricky scene, that all these people are exactly who they say they are, and have all the relationships that they have, and I think it's a really pretty impressive negotiation of ensemble, and feels more like a kind of punchline movie in the way that some people talk about it than something like Parenthood. But I think really, and it obviously has its limitations, but I think it deserves a really fair shake for how it coordinates all that, and
I think the key example for me in that regard is the salon sequence that, you know, starts off very casual and very bantery, and it just sort of has this really pleasant laid back flow, and then, you know, 10 minutes later we've got forced drinking of orange juice. I mean, but just the way that it leads to that point is it's so subtle. Like, you don't really, you're just sort of like, you know, along for the ride, and it's just really getting to know however many characters in that salon, like five or six, and, and the way that it just kind of bounces from one to the next, it just, it's almost like narrative just takes a back seat and you can just sort of be with them. And I think that's really amazing filmmaking. I would put that scene in like one of the top five scenes out of any of these movies that we're talking about.
Yeah.
I think there are a few more actors in that one, like Daryl Hannah and Dolly Parton, who came up earlier, who are really cast in the parts you would not think they'd be cast in general, but certainly in that movie. And Daryl Hannah, I think, does a really amazing job of playing somebody who even cosmetically looks like she'll probably be a joke, some of her lines really tilt that way, but the movie doesn't feel that way. And I don't feel about the Julia Roberts performance, Kevin, this is getting back to something you said a long time ago, but we have a kind of interesting orthogonal relationship to her performance, because I actually like it more as the movie goes on. And kind of appreciate that vibrancy that you talk about in scenes like when they're all playing the board game late at night and everybody's finding the upcoming surgery funny, except for Tom Skerritt.
Right.
Or just the scene where she, that turns out to be her last scene, picking up the baby, that it's not more kind of milking it, but she just seems comfortable on screen, which she doesn't seem super comfortable to me in the beginnings, even when she's being sort of more fabulous.
It's kind of funny how well you can track Daryl Hannah's character's emotional stability through her hair in that film, which is a very, very deliberate choice, I think. You know, when she first shows up and she's so off kilter about, you know, her husband and her life and the history that she's hiding, and she just has this like terrible blown out flat hair, and of course everybody else has ridiculous 1980s southern pompadour kind of hair going on, mm-hmm. and you can kind of get to watch her slowly fit into the community, you know, via learning to relax and trust people and kind of trust herself, but you also get to watch her learn to trust her hair, which is a ridiculous thing. But, you know, it's a very apt piece of set dressing, and it's certainly very deliberate.
Sure.
I think it's interesting to play off that that earlier point that Enemies of Love Story is the film about, you know, these three women and their relationships to their past and their relationships to this central guy, is the film in this set that's the least conscious of kind of women and, you know, how they live and what their concerns are and what their feelings are. You know, I think Parenthood gets very deeply into the feelings of motherhood and being a single mom, and My Left Foot really does care about the relationship between Brenda Fricker's character and her children, and especially Christy, and is just this great portrait of this warm, loving motherhood, the way that she kind of sees something in him that possibly nobody else sees when he can't communicate with the rest of the world. And then Steel Magnolias is so caught up in a women's view of the world, you know, in a field where so few films pass the Bechdel test, where so few films care at all what women think. I think it's a little fascinating that the movie that's about three women, it falls into that category of it only barely passes the Bechdel test, because at the end you have two women talking about the baby, but really that's about it. It's right. Just it's so centric on that male perspective.
And is the baby a male or female? Because if it's a male, then it fails the Bechdel test.
I'm pretty sure the baby's a daughter, because they name her after Masha.
Right. Oh, that's right, yeah.
Actually, since you brought up, let's see, oh yeah, Daryl Hannah's hair. I always like to think about, like, you know, best assist by prosthetics and or makeup in a performance. You know, sometimes it's like really what we're reacting to without knowing it. You know, Nicole Kidman and The Hours and so forth. And I guess for me, I would go with Angelica Houston's makeup, because just something really expressive about how her face is painted. Like, you just tell, like, you know, it's covering something, both literally and symbolically. Like, it's almost like a mask the first time you see her emerge. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you almost feel like this face has been somehow reconstructed, just through some, you know, tidying up, and maybe the hair has been, is a wig or it's dyed. There's just something very put together about it that is very compelling. You just feel like this woman's fragile and sort of being held together by like wire.
And
her tiny little cocked hat does that for me.
Yeah,
the wee little side of head feathered cap that she wears, I think, is just sort of the illustration of her kind of transitioning from, you know, old world, doesn't know who she is, to sophisticate. And it's, I mean, it's an affectation, but it's a very apt affectation.
You just made me realize how Eat Your Apricot Goop, Masha, is a great companion piece to Drink Your Juice, Shelby. both of them might grow up to Eat Your Fish, Bitch from August Osage County.
Another film about motherhood.
Oh, boy.
About warm and loving motherhood.
Right.
That film has a really great Julia Roberts performance, though. I mean, I think it's an awful film and an awful concept for a film, and has a lot of problems. But at least it does have women talking to each other, and it has a performance from Julia Roberts that I think is just mesmerizing.
Yeah, and I guess it kind of, you know, ties the circles of square, I guess, with Steel Magnolias and what she does in there, because it's like, at the end of the day, she's just a very aggressive alpha type actress.
And yes.
There's just this energy and this aggression that she, you know, the best thing she can do is just figure out how to channel it. You know, even Pretty Woman, it's just like part of what was so appealing about her in that film is like she managed to be really assertive and, you know, go for it without being threatening. Somehow have vulnerability come through in the midst of that go-getterness. And I guess, you know, August Osage County is just like a variation of that, where she's playing off this sort of like brittleness or this woundedness, and at the same time being very, like, you know, acerbic and aggressive.
There's also, I mean, there's a realism, I think, to just the rawness and flatness of her performance in August Osage County, which to me goes directly against who she is in Steel Magnolias. Nobody's really brought up her accent in Steel Magnolias, and that's something I'd be interested in hearing from people in general on. It's just because, for me, the film where everybody's trying to do a Southern accent and they're doing it with very different degrees of success can be a huge distraction, and her accent in this film was a huge distraction for me.
Which, as Nick pointed out, she's from Georgia, so it's like, what happened?
But that seems kind of typical, right, of the Southern actor who understands that being from Georgia and Louisiana are not the same, which people not from the South might not even bother worrying about, but she does sound like she's trying really hard to do something else. I wouldn't call it Louisiana, but it must be something.
Yeah. Well, we are basically out of time, but before we go, I just want to thank everyone again, and I want you to tell us, as we depart, what the line is from Steel Magnolias that you have quoted the most often in your life. So, Todd Vanderwerf, thanks again from Vox.
You're very welcome. And in my household, I do have to say that my wife frequently says, "Drink your juice." So that would have to be it.
And Tasha Robinson from The Dissolve.
You know what they say: if you don't have anything nice to say about anybody, come sit by me.
Tim Roby from The Telegraph.
I've only had a year to do this. I have not had it my whole life. And I'd be quoting Steel Magnolias.
I'm sure you've quoted something since you first
saw it. I think I'm just going to... I'm looking at the IMDb page, and I've just decided to choose one that I will now use. Which is, "Honey, time marches on, and eventually you realize it is marching across your face." But there we go.
Kevin B. Lee from Keyframe.
Right. "Drink your fucking juice, bitch." That's kind of an amalgam of two performances, but it works for me.
Nick Davis from Next Flick Picks.
It's usually when I'm stressed out about something that I'm bitching about, but end with, "But it will not interfere with my ability to do good hair."
Oh, you stole mine. Oh.